It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Anthony Kennedy is retiring, and we are talking about how that's going to affect the Supreme Court in the future. Donald Trump ran on a promise to change the court. Voters, including those in Wisconsin, elected him and Republicans to run Congress. What does this mean in the short term, and how will it affect the U.S. in the years to come? Do you like the timing of this? Do you wish that Kennedy had stayed on the bench? Should President Trump move right away to replace Kennedy, or should he push someone like Anthony Kennedy, much the same way that Mitch McConnell refused to hold hearings on Merrick Garland in order to name a justice who was more like Antonin Scalia? 800-642-1234 is the number here. Ideas at WPR.org is the way you can email us, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Andrew O'Gene is an associate professor of political science at Davidson College in North Carolina. He's an expert on the High Court, and he teaches a seminar called The Politics of the U.S. Supreme Court. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
So first off, your reaction to yesterday's announcement.
It was not entirely unexpected. There had been some rumblings during the course of the most recent term about Kennedy potentially retiring. It was not announced right away at the sort of conclusion of the term, and so that there was a little bit of news about potentially him not retiring this year, and then it kind of came out of the blue. So I mean, there was not a lot of buildup, but there were some rumblings during the term, and so it wasn't totally unexpected.
So what is this retirement going to mean for the court?
What it means for the court is that if the president follows his previous pattern and nominates a fairly conservative justice to replace Kennedy, it means that the ideological position of the court and the ideological center of the court moves substantially to the right, potentially for a considerable amount of time. And so the retirement and the nomination of a new justice is going to have important implications for the court going forward.
President Trump held a rally last night in North Dakota. Here is what he said about Justice Kennedy.
Great man. And I'm very honored that he chose to do it during my term in office because he felt confident in me to make the right choice and carry on his great legacy. That's why he did it.
Now, Andrew, there are a number of pundits who were surprised that Kennedy did this because they didn't think that he would do it during the Trump administration because he might be afraid that Trump might undo some of the things that Kennedy has done, especially around abortion rights and LGBT rights. Do you think, I think it's funny that Trump made it all about him, but do you think that Kennedy actually trusts that Trump is going to replace him and not undo his legacy?
I'm not so sure about that. My understanding is that the justices are pretty fiercely independent about the choice to retire, and there is some evidence that they make strategic decisions about when to retire, based on who happens to be in the presidency at the time. But when pressed on these things publicly, surely they will not say that this is part of their decision calculus at all. And so, it seems unlikely to me. He has reached a pretty advanced age. He's 81 years old. Mm-hmm. We don't expect people usually to work to that age, certainly in any other profession. And so, there's all kinds of reasons why people retire. It's not entirely clear that it was driven by a desire to allow the president to name his replacement. There are all kinds of potential reasons why people of that age might retire. There might be health issues that he's concerned about that he hasn't disclosed. There's all kinds of other possibilities. So the prospect that he retired to allow the president to name his successor certainly helps the president's narrative, but I'm not sure that it's supported by any sort of other data or information.
We are talking to Andrew Ogeen about the retirement of Anthony Kennedy. We are also taking your calls, 800-642-1234. What do you think of Kennedy's retirement? Were you surprised by this? So, Andrew, Kennedy was appointed by Republican President Ronald Reagan, but was widely regarded as the court's swing vote. How did he get that label?
He got that label because he was a justice who was willing to hold off on making decisions in a lot of cases, and he was a fairly reliable conservative vote on a lot of issues, but he was also a justice who sided with the liberals on the court on many social issues as well. And so just by virtue of his behavior, his voting behavior, he sort of positioned himself in the ideological middle of the court. And so he was oftentimes the justice that was needed for a coalition to form a majority. And so his opinion and his view on particular legal questions was particularly impactful.
And plaintiffs often would structure their argument so that they would appeal to Anthony Kennedy. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. So we saw a lot of evidence of that in the most recent same-sex marriage cases. There was an assumption that he was going to be the deciding vote in those cases, that he was going to write the opinion because he had written opinions on that issue in the past. And so a lot of the legal arguments were specifically crafted to account for his views.
You know, I want to talk about the history of the court, because Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor were both considered the moderates on the court, and then Sandra Day O'Connor retired. But has it always been this way? Has it always been a few people on the left and a few people on the right and one or two people in the middle kind of bringing things together? Or has it been that most justices were like Anthony Kennedy?
The former, actually. So the court has long had political divides going all the way back in its history, just by virtue of the fact that the court is staffed through a very political process. So they are nominated by a president who has political views and has an agenda about specific issues, and they're confirmed by members of the Senate, who also are subject to electoral accountability and have their own political agendas. And so the court is made up of people who are chosen through a very political process, and that those politics manifest themselves in the behavior of the justices. And so there's a long history on the court of political and ideological divisions, and it has traditionally been the case, certainly in recent times, that there is sort of an ideological middle on the court, and sometimes that's one justice, sometimes it's a couple, like we had with O'Connor and Kennedy. Going back slightly earlier in the 20th century, there was two or three justices that sort of formed the ideological middle of the court. And so there is a history on the court of polarization to a certain degree, but also of folks sort of living in the middle.
One of the things that that President Obama did in nominating Merrick Garland, who famously was not put on the Supreme Court, is that
Right.
he went for that ideological middle. He did not go for somebody on the partisan left. He went for somebody who Republicans would approve of also. Was that a good strategy?
Well, I mean, it was a strategy. I think that it was designed to put maximum pressure on the Senate Republicans to act on the nomination. President Obama nominated a judge who was largely seen as very qualified, who had an incredible amount of bipartisan support in the Senate, and sort of was forcing the Republican senators who had made public statements in support of Garland in previous years to go back on those public statements. So it was really designed to put a lot of pressure on the Republicans in the Senate to act on the nomination. And we see that fairly regularly. Presidents typically have been cognizant of the ideological makeup and the electoral politics that exist in the Senate, and have structured their nominees with respect to that those politics. So
That's okay. And since Garland failed because Mitch McConnell failed, would not bring him up to a vote or have a hearing for him, is that sort of like trying to spread the middle? Is that going to end? And are our presidents now from now on just going to put the most partisan people they can think of up?
Well, I mean, part of that was part of the reason the court was able to sort of have a little bit of ideological diversity was because of the process and because the Senate had largely followed a certain type of procedure in terms of nominations and confirmations. Justices were confirmed that were seen as qualified, and politics was part of the process, but it was not the overriding concern. And we are sort of moving away from that. The process has become much more politicized over time, and certainly McConnell's actions around the Garland and the Gorsuch nomination and confirmation seem to signal that the process is going to be much more politicized going forward, and we're likely to see presidents not feeling like they need to moderate their choices as much.
We are talking about Justice Anthony Kennedy's place in history as he retires and what the country is going to look like from now on. We're talking with political scientist Andrew Ogeen about the decision that Anthony Kennedy made yesterday. In a moment, we'll talk about what power, if any, the Democrats may have in choosing a new justice. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Within hours of the announcement that Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy is retiring, President Trump said he would name a replacement right away. Who is that going to be? Is the name already on the list that Trump has from the Conservative Federalist Society? And what will a conservative court look like? Political scientist Andrew Ogeen is helping us figure this out. 800-642-1234 is the number for you to call to weigh in on this. Ideas@WPR.org is the email. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. What is the most important quality for the next justice on the high court to you? Andrew, I want to get back to this swing vote idea for Kennedy before we move on to how this is going to play out in the next few months. Did Kennedy vote liberal or conservative more often?
He voted conservative more often, and certainly in this past term, he was a very. In fact, I'm not sure that he joined the four liberal justices at all this past term. But that was sort of an anomaly. Typically, we're talking probably about 20 or 30 percent of the time when he's in line, at least in some degree, with some of the liberal justices on the court. But he definitely voted conservative more often.
Interesting. We are taking your calls on Anthony Kennedy's retirement this morning. Thomas from Milwaukee, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me. From a court makeup standpoint, I'm not sure the Democrats need to be too concerned. I mean, he's characterized as a bit of a centrist, but the fact of the matter is Scalia was very far right, originalist type, and Gorsuch is somewhat more moderate. John Roberts has shown himself to be a little bit more moderate. And Kennedy, as your guest just said, has been voting with the liberals pretty solidly. So I'm not sure whatever happens here will be that much of a difference. But I wanted to talk about the Republican politics about all of this a little bit, because I think it's a big win for Trump, and it's an opportunity, again, for him to shore up his Republican base, which has been iffy, to say the least. If you follow the right wing folks on Twitter at all, you'll see that there's been a pretty substantial Never Trump movement, and they've always kind of poo-pooed the Gorsuch appointment as no big deal, and they've always maintained their credibility in conservative circles by saying Trump isn't conservative enough, he's a New York business Democrat, etc., he's weak on trade, that kind of stuff. This really wipes all of that away, and for any conservative, even Tea Party types who are skeptical of Trump, to now complain, I mean, I've seen it on Twitter just within the last day, you know, everybody's apologized for being Never Trump, and so those people are going to have to make a choice. You know, there's folks like the Sykes of the world and J. Jonah Goldberg or David French or whomever that regularly appear on MSNBC, those folks are just going to have to call themselves Democrats now or, you know, kind of be quiet. And I think the Democrats, that's a big loss. So they should think seriously about the politics of all of this. And I just wonder what your guess is.
That's a great question, Thomas. A lot of people voted for Trump, Andrew, because they wanted the Supreme Court. That was their main thing. And a lot of never Trumpers said, look, it doesn't really matter. He's not going to give us the Supreme Court. And there are a lot of other things that we don't like about him. Has this shored up the Republican base and maybe brought in the people who were skeptical?
I think for sure that is one of the potential outcomes here. I think the Gorsuch nomination did that a little bit, and so it remains to be seen. It seems like that the Trump administration understands the power of this decision to do exactly what the caller is talking about. I'm not sure that Jonah Goldberg is in any danger of calling himself a Democrat anytime soon, but. The Trump administration is certainly aware of the electoral politics here and the degree to which a nomination of a mainline Federalist Society conservative judge is going to bring some potential never-Trumpers into the fold.
A Washington Post story about Kennedy's retirement includes this line: Washington could be in for an epic battle over Kennedy's replacement. So let's talk about this epic battle. What's it going to look like in the next few months?
Well, it seems that the Republicans in the Senate want to move as quickly as possible to get a nominee in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee and then on the Senate floor for a vote, probably by the beginning of the Supreme Court term, so that the court is not hearing cases with an open seat, and certainly before the midterm elections. And so, over the course of the next couple of months, there's going to be a lot of speculation first about who the president is going to choose, and then once that choice is made, there's going to be some serious action in terms of the media. Certainly, the Democrats are going to and Democratic groups are going to make a strong case against whomever the president chooses. And there's going to be some disagreements, certainly, about the timing of this with the election coming so close. But it doesn't seem like it's going to matter a whole lot.
The New York Times has a list of potential nominees for the court. There's a Wisconsin name on the list, Diane Sykes of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. She's on the radar. We're going to keep an eye on that. Do you know anything about her, Andrew?
I don't, actually. Sorry.
That's okay. So Senate Democrats don't have the numbers, as you just pointed out, to block this nominee. They do, though, almost have the numbers. I mean, they're talking about swaying some Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, to maybe help them block a Supreme Court nominee until the November elections. Do you think that's possible?
It's possible, but it doesn't seem very probable. I think that there are a couple of issues where certainly Collins and Murkowski might disagree with a nominee here, and I'm thinking specifically about abortion rights.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is that it just seems pretty unlikely that they're going to be that dissatisfied with a conservative nominee to the court that they'd be willing to be the sort of lone voice against the president here.
Right.
Neither of them is facing an immediate reelection battle, and certainly Collins, her statewide politics are a little different than Murkowski's, but it seems like an unlikely outcome.
So one of the things that I've been questioning, though, is, okay, so what if they do hold off having a nominee until the November elections, and what if in some miraculous way the Democrats take the Senate? Then what, they're going to not nominate a Supreme Court justice for 2 years? I mean, like, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right?
Yeah, so I think what would be likely is that you would end up with a nomination, probably a nomination of someone from the list, maybe a denial or a denial of that nominee, and then you're left with a choice. The president is left with a choice. Does he renominate someone from the list of frankly very conservative judges, or does he try to moderate the choice there? And it's unclear. I mean, I think, you know, predicting what this president is going to do is not necessarily the smartest move. So it's a little difficult to know exactly how that would turn out, but he would certainly be faced with a choice. And it might be the case that the president might relish that inaction by a Democratic Senate and try and use it as a tool in the 2020 election.
We are talking with Andrew Ogeen, who is an associate professor of political science at Davidson College in North Carolina. We're talking about Anthony Kennedy's retirement and who might replace him. We are also taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Joe from Milwaukee, I hope, is this the same Joe that called earlier? Welcome to the program.
I haven't called today.
Good. You got it. So what's your question?
I think it's important that whoever is appointed needs to be someone who will interpret the amendments of the Constitution to mean what the people who passed those amendments understood it to mean, and not try to impose like modern views on what these amendments mean, because that's not the proper way to do law. If they want to change the Constitution, they should amend the Constitution and not simply just invent law out of nothing.
So you are an originalist, Joe?
You could say that, yes.
Okay. Andrew, what do you say?
Well, I mean, I think reasonable people can disagree about that. I think certainly there is disagreement among the justices on the court about whether that's the correct way to sort of understand the Constitution. But Joe's perspective is not an uncommon one, and it's certainly one that is likely to be shared by the eventual nominee.
So we are talking about Anthony Kennedy's retirement, and where the court is going to be going with Andrew Ogeen. It's been a pretty good week for President Trump, Andrew. The high court ruled his way on the travel ban, and now the president gets to pick a new justice for the Supreme Court. How much of a boon is this to the president?
I think it's a really big deal for the president, actually. I think, like you said earlier, court picks and staffing the judiciary was a big part of his campaign and a big part of the way that he was able to attract some skeptical conservatives. And so the ability to name another Supreme Court justice, I think, is an important one for the president. And certainly, having the court sign off on a particular policy is always something that lends a little bit of legitimacy.
We are talking about Anthony Kennedy's retirement, and we are taking your calls. Mary from Lancaster, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. My comment is that there is no more a democratic society in this country, because the minute that the Senate blocked President Obama's constitutional rights to nominate a Supreme Court justice, and they blocked it, Mitch McConnell, right there our democracy failed. And denied that, and because all the stuff that's going on with Trump and the standards and morals of this country, we're more in line with countries like Russia, North Korea, Syria. We are not a democracy anymore.
Mary from Lancaster, thank you very much for that. We are not a democracy anymore. Andrew, do you agree with that, or is this a bit of maybe overstatement?
Well, I mean, it might be a bit of an overstatement, but I think that certainly we can look to the politics of the last year or two and see an erosion of sort of traditional democratic norms that had been in place for a long time. We spent a lot of time in political science thinking about how norms shape people's behavior, things that are not necessarily written down or laws per se, but sort of norms of behavior and ways of interacting. Certainly over the course of the last couple of years, beginning with the sort of election campaign and through the election and the first year of the Trump presidency, we can see the erosion of some of these norms. And I think that's what Mary's sort of picking up on, is that a lot of the things that we sort of took for granted as the way politics work were rooted in sort of culture and tradition. Mm. And those things are only as strong as the people that are sort of living under those norms. If they're unwilling to perpetuate them, then they go away.
Yeah, it's been interesting, actually, to see that things are traditional. There are a lot of things that a lot of people took for granted as being law are just kind of the way maybe the Senate chooses to do things, and they don't have to do them this way. Have you found that a lot of people are surprised by how politics actually works?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think that we certainly, especially in the media, when there's not a lot of discussion about where these rules come from, or why they exist, there is oftentimes an assumption that that is the way the law requires people to behave. And certainly in the United States, a lot of politics is governed by unwritten rules, norms of behavior, and that sort of thing. And those things can be stable over time to a certain degree, but certainly they are subject to being dislodged.
So we are talking about Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement this morning. Previous presidents have treated their options for the Supreme Court in many different ways. Ideally, what should a president be weighing when figuring out who should be on the court?
Yeah, I mean, the glib answer to that is that it depends who you ask. And so I think that traditionally what presidents look for is someone who is well qualified. And so what this has meant in the recent past is that the person has served as a judge, usually at the federal appellate level. This is not a requirement necessarily, and it's certainly not historically been true. But in recent years, that has been a sort of starting point for most of the nominations. There had been a process by which the Bar Association had ranked nominees as qualified or supremely qualified or unqualified, and that has sort of fallen by the wayside over the course of the last few rounds of this process. The other thing is that the president wants someone who is going to be politically uncontroversial, and so someone who has problems in their past with the law or problems with specific decision-making. A lot of recent nominees have been chosen because they have not been very vocal about specific issues in public, and so there is a desire to sort of make the process as smooth as possible.
My question here is, how are lawyers trying to figure this out? Like we talked earlier about the fact that many lawsuits have been structured to appeal to Anthony Kennedy. Are there now issues that lawyers were going to take through the courts with an eye towards hitting the high court that they are not going to take now because they may not win them?
I think, well, certainly litigants make strategic choices. There's no question about that. The Supreme Court bar is a pretty specialized group, and so folks that argue cases in front of the Supreme Court, typically you have several examples of sort of one-off people, but many of the people who argue in front of the Supreme Court do it repeatedly, and so they are very attuned to the types of issues the court is interested in hearing, what types of arguments they find persuasive and what types of arguments they don't find persuasive. And so at a very specific level, attorneys that are representing clients at the Supreme Court understand very clearly what types of arguments they need to make. There are definitely interest groups and attorneys who are making choices about whether or not to litigate cases based on whether they think they can win at the Supreme Court. I think that's definitely right.
We are talking about Anthony Kennedy's retirement and taking your calls. Joe from Waukesha, welcome to the program.
I guess what I'd call it is perhaps the Warren effect. What I mean by that is that perhaps whoever this person we now have in the Oval Office decides to select someone who he thinks is safe and is going to be another Gorsuch and basically constantly push the court further and further to the right. Eisenhower, when he selected Earl Warren, who became the Chief Justice, thought he was selecting someone who was going to be safe, was going to be quite conservative. And, of course, he proved to be quite the opposite. And Warren later talked about how racist Eisenhower was. He mentioned, after the Brown versus the Board of Education, Eisenhower said to Warren, "Now, you wouldn't want your daughter sitting next to a big black buck, would you?" And he was shocked at Eisenhower's statement. But my point is that possibly, I doubt it at this stage, but possibly we may get someone appointed who turns out to be quite progressive, quite liberal, and quite shocking, I guess, for the present occupant of the Oval Office.
Joe, thank you for that. So is that possible now, Andrew, for somebody chosen in our very polarized system to change their mind over time?
Yes, I think, I mean, to sort of mirror my previous answer, I think it's possible, although it's I think it's largely improbable. There is definitely a lot of evidence that the justices move ideologically in their time on the court, and there are lots of instances where conservative justices have sort of drifted to the left. The most recent examples are Harry Blackmun and John Paul Stevens sort of ending their careers on the court considerably to the left of where they started. And Joe's example of Warren is another. George Bush's nomination of David Souter was seen as sort of a surprise by many conservative pundits and voters. It seems unlikely, though, that in this day and age, with all of that history behind us and all of the information that we have and the degree to which this process has become a high-stakes one, that we're going to get a surprise candidate.
We are talking about Anthony Kennedy's retirement and taking your calls. What is your view of this retirement? Do you think it's a good thing? Are you worried about the future of the Supreme Court? 800-642-1234. We will be back with Andrew Ogene in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Where will the Supreme Court go after Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement? And what is the fight likely to be like to replace him? We're talking with political scientist Andrew Ogene. And we are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. What is the most important quality for the next justice of the high court for you? Does Kennedy's retirement motivate you to vote in the midterms? Did you cast your ballot to vote for president based on the Supreme Court? 1-800-642-1234. Elaine from Colfax, welcome to the program.
Hi. I believe Trump is getting way too much credit for this decision. I don't think it's his own accomplishment if his pick get selected because he doesn't really care who it is. He's intellectual lazy. Just like the health care issue, I don't think he does his homework at all. I think he leaves it to others. So like most things with his administration, unless it has to do with money or breaking down the EPA's mission, he just doesn't care.
So he doesn't care, but Andrew, that doesn't mean that his decisions now won't have a lasting effect.
That's certainly true. I mean, I think that he has. It's probably likely that he has outsourced a good portion of the decision making on this choice, but it will certainly have a lasting impact on the court. And so I think that you know, it's worth paying attention to for sure.
So outsourcing, he does have a list from the Federal Society that has been widely reported. Do all presidents do that? Do all presidents kind of say, hey, you expert group over there, let me know who you want to be nominated?
It's actually highly unusual for the president to publicize that list. And so the release of the list during the campaign and then the updating of the list this past November was something that was highly unusual. But most presidents will maintain a relatively short list of potential nominees or judges that they're paying attention to in terms of federal court nominees and Supreme Court nominees. It's usually an internal document, and they will solicit advice from experts. They will usually have a staffer whose job it is to sort of maintain that process, and that person will oftentimes reach out to experts or to other people who have knowledge of this information.
I thought it was interesting. He publicized the list largely as a campaign tactic. Vote for me and you will get a conservative Supreme Court, and that's what people have gotten.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, it's an unusual thing. Most often in presidential politics, the Supreme Court will come up, but it's not a sort of highly charged issue. And Trump certainly made it a centerpiece of the campaign.
So let's talk about the gerrymandering. The gerrymandering case is likely to it was remanded to the lower courts, and Justice Kagan said, "Hey." You could, if you do this, and this, then maybe it'll pass. Is it even going to come back to the Supreme Court now?
Well, the way that the court works in terms of deciding which cases to take, they only need four justices to approve of a case in order to hear it. And so there are likely four justices who would be interested in deciding that case. The trick, though, is that those four justices also understand that they might be more likely to lose at this point. Mm. And so what we in political science would call that a defensive denial, where the case might come back to the Supreme Court, but the justices in the minority might decide not to hear the case or vote not to hear the case because they don't want to set a national precedent in a way that is contrary to their preferences.
We are talking about Anthony Kennedy's retirement and taking your calls. Erline from Neillsville, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. My main concern is during the campaign, Trump promised to get rid, that he would vote someone for the Supreme Court to get rid of Roe versus Wade and restrict other women's choices. I think every woman that votes in the primary should have this consideration. The only hopeful thing I can think of is that the Mueller report will come out before the primary, hopefully.
The Mueller report. So if the Mueller report comes out before the primary, thank you very much, Erline, for that. It is unfavorable to Donald Trump. Does that really affect his Supreme Court pick and what the Senate does?
I think it depends on the degree to which it's unfavorable. I think that if the Mueller report is very clear about evidence that the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians or some sort of other sort of major malfeasance by the Trump campaign, it might cast a shadow over the nomination process. But if the evidence seems to be a little bit grayer, the president has shown an incredible ability to withstand what would derail many other political careers, and so it remains to be seen.
We are talking about Anthony Kennedy's resignation, and we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Andrew, there's a foundation of checks and balances in our democracy, and we have seen, I think, all three branches of government sort of like stretch those checks and balances. Is this still healthy? Are we a healthy democracy now?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think, like I said before, a lot of the strength of our democracy is rooted in respect for traditions and norms, and certainly an appreciation for the role that checks and balances play in the constitutional system in the United States. And you know, those norms have been challenged in the past. And just like they're sort of challenged currently, and they have stood the test of time, the degree to which they are sort of elastic and flexible, I think we don't know exactly what the limits are, but certainly there are challenges right now. I think what's going to happen is that the midterm election is going to be a very important turning point here. Traditionally, the president's party loses seats in the midterm election, and so the Republicans losing seats this November is fairly likely given history. But the extent to which that happens, or the degree to which that happens, and the effect that has on politics in Washington, will sort of tell the tale.
We are taking your calls here about Anthony Kennedy. Annie from Watertown, welcome to the program.
Hi. I find it sort of strange that following the Constitution is considered a tradition and norm as far as ignoring Garland's nomination. But what I was wondering about, I found it very, very bizarre that it got very little news play that while Gorsuch's hearings were going on, the Supreme Court overturned his decision unanimously. And has anything like that ever happened before?
Hang on a second, Joe. Andrew, what do you understand what she's talking about?
I think she's referencing a decision that Gorsuch made as a lower court judge. Is that right?
Yeah, where he just like created something out of thin air, and his judgment was based on that, and they just unanimously overturned him.
Yeah, I mean, that I'm not sure if it's happened during the process in the past. I think there were instances. I think there was a case that Justice Sotomayor decided as a lower court judge that was overturned around the time of her confirmation. But I don't recall an instance where it happened sort of during the confirmation process. But the fact of being overturned once by the Supreme Court is. It is a newsworthy thing, but I'm not sure that it's a deal breaker in terms of a person's qualifications.
Yeah, but it's interesting that if he had been on the court, it wouldn't have been a unanimous vote.
He would have had to recuse himself.
Right. There's that. Jim from Wanakee, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for the program. I just wanted to say that I have lost a lot of respect for the Supreme Court as an institution ever since the election of George W. Bush, when Al Gore won that election, and then, of course, the Supreme Court selected us a president
right back
then. And so I'm thinking that in the same way with Kennedy, I've always had a lot of respect for Kennedy, but until lately, in that what did it for me was when he, approved that ban, the Muslim ban.
Right.
And to me, that's just like, did it.
And that was just a few days ago that Muslim ban was approved. As you noted earlier, Andrew, Kennedy has voted with a conservative majority this entire time, this year on the court. But I think Jim's first point was kind of an interesting one, if you want to take that. That the courts, I'm kind of lost here. That the courts, and
yeah, I mean, I,
yeah,
I'm,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. That yeah, I mean, he was referencing the sort of legitimacy of the court as an institution, and it's something actually that political scientists spend a lot of time thinking about. Certainly, and there's a lot of recent research about what drives people's perceptions of the court. And what drives the degree to which people sort of view the institution as legitimate. It turns out the court's institutional legitimacy is pretty resilient, although it has been sort of dropping in recent years. The court enjoys a pretty wide and pretty deep level of support from the public as an institution, certainly way more than Congress as an institution necessarily. And it turns out that individual cases oftentimes will anger people in terms of their sort of attitude about how the case ought to have come down, but will not have a significant impact on their sort of institutional view of the court. And, you know, the degree to which that can be compounded, right? So what we see with the court is that they're oftentimes reluctant to take a lot of very high-profile, divisive cases in one particular term because there is a worry that, you know, deciding a bunch of those cases all at once can potentially maybe negatively impact that institutional legitimacy a little bit more.
We are still taking your calls. Alyssa from Lake Geneva, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
So what is your... go ahead.
Yeah, my question was about women's reproductive rights. So I had seen in response to Kennedy's retirement, a lot of women on social media calling for other women to go vote. And
you there? Okay, so we're having technical issues here. Alyssa from Lake Geneva, what I'm reading is that she saw women on social media saying that they should get contraceptives and birth control because, as she dropped the call, because those rights are going to be taken away. What do you answer to that, Andrew?
Well, I mean, it's certainly true that the status of the Roe versus Wade precedent and the ability of states to restrict abortion access is going to be something that's on the table in the next year to 18 months. And I'm not sure that there needs to necessarily be a run on contraceptives this moment, but it's certainly something that people should be paying attention to. I think that certainly as a political issue or an electoral issue, that is a totally legitimate concern.
And there are cases that are coming up that will likely make it in front of the court in the next year or so that have to do with birth control and abortion?
I'm not sure about the docket specifically right now, but you can bet that it won't be long.
We've been talking about the news from yesterday that Justice Anthony Kennedy is retiring. Andrew O'Jean is an associate professor of political science at Davidson College in North Carolina. He's an expert on the high court, and he teaches a seminar called The Politics of the U.S. Supreme Court. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Carrie. It was my pleasure.
The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, and Laura Pavin. Dave Potraz has provided technical direction today. Keely Boltina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network.